Today is January the 13th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank at pcradioshow.org. Facebook paid $16 billion back in 2014 for WhatsApp. WhatsApp is a messaging app that lets users text, chat, and share media, including voice messages and video, with individuals or groups. The main draw of WhatsApp is to allow you to send and receive calls and messages using only an internet connection, which means it's virtually free to use and ideal for international calling. There are no fees to sign up and no data plan allowances to worry about. While WhatsApp is similar to other messaging services like iMessage or Messages by Google, it still offers a few key advantages, the most significant being cross-platform functionality. With over 2 billion active users, WhatsApp is especially popular among friends and family who live in different countries and want to stay in touch. The Facebook-owned app is easily one of the most popular messaging services in the world. It was one of the first mobile apps to offer free internet-based messaging. Instead of sending texts using cellular data networks where fees may apply, WhatsApp primarily relies on Wi-Fi connections to send and receive messages and calls for free. Once you set up your WhatsApp account, you can begin sending messages through the platform, either to individual contacts or to groups. If you want added security, you can set up two-step verification in WhatsApp setting menu. You can also share your location on WhatsApp, whether you're trying to meet up with friends or want someone to know exactly where you are. So what's new now with WhatsApp? WhatsApp has told its 2 billion users that they must agree to share their data with Facebook in order to keep using the service. Users are being alerted to the controversial change to WhatsApp privacy policy via an in-app notification, asks them to agree to share personal data, including their phone number, with Facebook. By tapping agree, you accept the new terms, which takes effect on February 8th, 2021. The notification states that after this date, you need to accept the new terms to continue using WhatsApp. You can also visit the Help Center if you would prefer to delete your account. Other data set to be shared with WhatsApp parent company includes battery level, signal strength, app version, browser information, mobile network, connection information including phone number of mobile operator or ISP, language and time zone, IP address, device operations information, and identifies, including identifies unique to Facebook company products associated with the same device or account. Those who don't accept the revamped privacy policy by February 8th will no longer be able to use the app. The policy update is designed to offer integration across the Facebook company products, which also includes Instagram and Messenger, according to WhatsApp. A WhatsApp spokesperson also said that it comes as part of a previously disclosed move to allow businesses to store and manage WhatsApp chats using Facebook infrastructure. The new terms and condition also means that simply deleting the app will not prevent WhatsApp from retaining a user's private data. To ensure the service no longer continue to do this, users must instead use the in-app feature for deleting their account. The policy notes that even after using this delete feature, some data will remain with the company, stating when you delete your account, it does not affect your information related to the groups you created or the information other users have relating to you, such as their copy of the message you sent them. The move comes a month after Apple started requiring iOS app makers, including WhatsApp, to detail the information they collect from users. According to the App Store, WhatsApp reserves the right to collect, purchase, financial information, location, contacts, user contents, identifiers, usage data, and diagnostics. Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Nearly 30% of working professionals would quit if they had to return to the office. Many companies plan to ask their employees to return to the office once a COVID-19 vaccine is widely available later this year. 29% of working professionals say they would quit their jobs if they couldn't continue working remotely, according to an online survey of 1,022 professionals by Live Career, an online resume and job search consulting service. 42% of the United States workforce has been working from home full-time during the pandemic, according to the Stanford University study. Those teleworking are generally white-collar office workers who can perform their jobs with a phone and computer. The survey underscores that at least some businesses and their workers may be on a collision course as life gradually returns to normal and employers start requiring staffers to come back to the mothership. 61% of the white-collar workers surveyed said they want their company to let them work remotely indefinitely, even after the pandemic is over, while 79% said that their company plans to return to on-site work eventually. Employees now expect to be able to work flexibly, says Chief of HR Research at Gartner. They feel they should be able to decide where and when they work, and if they are not given that choice, some will look for other employers that will offer that. Flexibility over where they work will be viewed much like the way a 401k is viewed, as a basic component of the employment deal. Those who don't offer it will have a harder time hiring and retaining employees. Professionals in some industries are less adamant about continuing to work from home. Just 7% of retail, wholesale, and distribution center employees would switch jobs if they couldn't keep telecommuting. But 35% of information technology workers would both. Those surveyed highlighted remote work's advantages, with 64% citing flexibility, 44% pointed to improved work-life balance, 40% feeling safer, 29% increased productivity, and 10% being able to acquire new career skills. There may be room for employers and their staffers to compromise. 90% of 130 human resources leaders surveyed by Gartner last month said they plan to let employees work remotely at least part of the time, even after a vaccine is widely adopted. About 30% of professionals surveyed by Live Career said that if going back to the office is inevitable, they like to work 3 days a week. 25% said 2 days a week, and 19% said 1 day a week. Just 9% said 4 days. WikiLeaks successor, DDO Secrets, has amassed a controversial new collection of corporate secrets and is sharing them in the name of transparency. For years, radical transparency-focused activists like WikiLeaks have blurred the line between whistleblowing and hacking. Often, they publish any data they consider to be of public interest, no matter how questionable the source. But now one leak focus group is mining a controversial new vein of secrets. The massive caches of data stolen by ransomware crews and dumped online when victims refuse to pay. Today, the Transparency Collective of data activists known as Distributed Denial of Secrets published a massive new set of data on its website, all collected from dark web sites where the information was originally leaked online by ransomware hackers. DDO Secrets has made available about 1 terabyte of that data, including more than 750,000 emails, photos, and documents from 5 companies. The group is also offering to privately share an additional almost 2 terabytes of data from more than a dozen other firms with selected journalists or academic researchers. In total, the giant data collection spans industries including pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, finance, software, retail, real estate, and oil and gas. All that data, along with terabytes more, that DDO Secrets says it plans to offer in the coming weeks and months, is sourced from an increasing common practice among cybercriminal ransomware operations. Beyond just encrypting victims' machines and demanding a payment for the decryption keys, ransomware hackers now often steal vast collections of victim data and threaten to post it online unless their hacking targets pay. In many cases, the victims refuse that extortion, and the cyber criminals follow through on their threat. The result is dozens or even hundreds of terabytes of internal corporate data spills out onto dark web servers whose web addresses are passed around among hackers and security researchers. DDO Secrets co-founder Emma Best argues that the trail of dump data that ransomware operations leave in their wake often contains information that deserves to be scrutinized and in some cases revealed to the public. Exploiting data leakage left behind by cyber criminal hackers carries new ethical questions. Some think that if your intentions are good, you're taking advantage of somebody who has a crime committed against them. Emma Best counters that DDO Secrets isn't publishing any data that wasn't already made public by those hackers. All of that data are things ransomware hackers have already released. They're saying we're not receiving anything directly from them or working with them in any way. Well, they're making available a forum for them to use. They're saying that they're just taking data that journalists are unable or afraid to access and making it available. Emma Best adds that the majority of cases, DDO Secrets won't publish the data themselves, but instead will share most of the leaks privately with journalists and researchers. In those cases, they'll ask that those who publish the data redact anything that is overly sensitive, as if that's going to happen all the time, such as personally identifying information and doesn't have public interest value. Who determines what is public interest value? But the group doesn't rule out publishing that sensitive information themselves if they do see a public interest value in it, and it plans to offer the same discretion to publish to the journalists and academics it shares data with. DDO Secrets also notes that the very cyber criminals who might make use of personally identifiable information in ransomware leaks are already scouring those leaks, regardless of whether DDO Secrets collect them or not. Of course, the bogeyman in this is everyone loves to worry about, she says, is they already got the data. Emma Best points to ignoring valuable data that can inform the public about how industries operate isn't something we can afford to do. The ethics of digging through that cornucopia of leaked data for public interest information comes down to more than the question of whether it was leaked by an insider or stolen by a hacker, or even the intentions of whatever the hacker might have stolen it. Emma Best says that ignoring the existence of ransomware data only allows cyber criminals to exploit it while leaving its value as a source of newsworthy muckraking or other public benefit. She says that our ultimate goal is and always has been to serve and inform the public. The question I raise is, when or if does the ends justify the means? Ticketmaster admits it hacked a rival company. Ticketmaster used stolen passwords and URL guessing to access confidential data. Ticketmaster Entertainment is an American ticket sales and distribution company. The company's ticket sales are fulfilled digitally for both primary and secondary markets. Ticketmasters include venues, artists, and promoters. Clients control their events and set ticket prices, and Ticketmaster sell tickets that the clients make available to them. Ticketmaster has agreed to pay a $10 million criminal fine after admitting its employees repeatedly use stolen passwords and other means to hack a rival ticket sales company. The fine, which is part of a deferred prosecution agreement Ticketmaster entered with federal prosecutors, resolves criminal charges filed in federal court in the Eastern District of New York. Charges include violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, computer intrusion for commercial advantage or private financial gain, computer intrusion in furtherance of fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, and wire fraud. In the settlement, Ticketmaster admitted that an employee who used to work for a rival company emailed the login credentials for multiple accounts the rival used to manage pre-sale ticket sales. At a San Francisco meeting attended by at least 14 employees of Ticketmaster or its parent's company, Live Nation, the employee used one set of credentials to log into an account to demonstrate how it worked. The employee who wasn't identifying court documents later provided Ticketmaster executive with internal and confidential financial documents he had retained from his previous employer. The employee was later promoted to Director of Client Relations and given a big raise. Court documents didn't identify the rival company, but Variety reported it was Songkick, which in 2017 filed a lawsuit accusing Ticketmaster of hacking its database. A few months later, Songkick went out of business. The charges against Ticketmaster comes 26 months after the former head of Ticketmaster's Artist Services Division pled guilty in a related case conspiring to hack the rival company and engage in wire fraud. According to prosecutors, the former rival employee emailed the login credentials to him and another Ticketmaster employee. When employees walk out of one company and into another, it's illegal for them to take proprietary information with them. Ticketmaster used stolen information to gain an advantage over its competition and then promoted the employees who broke the law. Besides providing login credentials, the former employee also showed Ticketmaster managers how to exploit a flaw in the URL generation scheme the rival used for unpublished ticketing web pages. To prevent the pages from being accessed by outsiders before they were made public, each one had a unique numerical value. The former employee told his new employer that the values were generated sequentially, and outsiders could use this information to view artists' pages while they were still in early draft stages. In early 2015, Ticketmaster assigned one of its employees to learn about this system and use it to maintain a spreadsheet listing every ticketing web page that could be located. Ticketmaster would then identify the rival company's clients and attempted to dissuade them from selling stolen tickets through the victim's company. Besides paying the $10 million fine, Ticketmaster has also agreed to maintain a compliance and ethics program designed to prevent and detect future hacking and unlawful acquisitions of competitors' confidential information. Ticketmaster responded to a request for comment with the following statement. Ticketmaster terminated both Zaidi and Mead in 2017 after their conduct came to light. Their actions violated our corporate policies and were inconsistent with our values. We are pleased that this matter is now resolved. Gee, the management didn't know about it? It sounded like they were in on it. Verizon puts 3G shutdown plans on hold indefinitely. It will keep the network operational alongside its 4G and 5G networks. Verizon isn't shutting down its 3G network anytime soon. Verizon's 3G network is operational and that it doesn't have a plan to shut it down at this time. Verizon has been taking steps towards shutting down its 3G network for years, starting way back in 2012 when it deployed 4G LTE. A few years later, it announced its plan to deactivate the network by December 2019. But it later pushed the date back to 2020. Now it looks like the company has delayed the old network shutdown indefinitely, perhaps until most of its remaining 3G customers have already moved to newer devices. Verizon stopped activating 3G phones in 2018 to facilitate a smooth transition to LTE-capable products and services. Verizon said at the time that virtually all traffic on its network is on 4G LTE network. Well, that didn't happen. Verizon didn't reveal how many of its subscribers still have 3G devices, but the figure could be significant if it chose to keep the network operational alongside of 4G and 5G. And Verizon may be actively encouraging 3G customers to get newer devices going forward. But many of these low-cost phones use the 3G network, and a great many users of the cell phone just want a plain cell phone. They don't need all that smartphone capability, 4G, 5G, GPS, camera. Oh, can't they come up with a simple telephone that is within everyone's budget? Well, the year 2020 has been a big one for AMD. AMD has just edged out Intel in desktop CPU market for the first time in 15 years on the strength of its Ryzen series of processors, which was initially released in 2017. The market share figures gathered by Passmark Software Performance Test Benchmarking show that AMD has 50.8% share of the Windows desktop CPU market worldwide compared to 49.2% for Intel on January the 4th. The last time AMD beat out Intel was in the first quarter of 2006 with a peak of 53.9% of market share, which it lasted the following quarter as Intel went on a 11-year tear and came close to claiming nearly 80% of the desktop CPU market in the fourth quarter of 2016. With the release of the AMD Ryzen series of CPUs in 2017, however, things quickly turned around for Team Red. It has quickly climbed back to parity with Intel, with offerings like the Ryzen 7 5800X and Ryzen 9, the 5900X, less than 3 months old. There's little reason to think that AMD will slip the way the company did the last time. As more systems are benchmarked, these numbers are bound to change, so it remains to be seen if AMD can keep up its climb. But given Intel's difficulty in moving their processors to a 7-nanometer architecture, AMD appears to have a fairly clear path to beating Intel in the desktop CPU space in the years ahead. Intel still, however, dominates in the mobile computing and server markets. While Intel might have lost this round on the desktop CPU front, its laptop and server CPU market shares are absolutely dominant. As TechSpot points out, with 83.7% of the Windows laptops tested running on Intel CPU, AMD has a long way to go before they can catch up with Intel. It's even more one-sided on the server side, where Intel enjoys a 98.6% market share, with AMD powering just over 1% of servers tested. While these numbers are heavily lopsided, it only took AMD 4 years to come back from a similar position, getting nearly shut out of the desktop CPU front. So if anyone can, AMD has shown that it certainly has the chops to do it. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, guidance for choosing IT jobs.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time for me to give you some benefit of my experience in the IT field as an IT professional for 30 years. And I want to talk about something that comes up on a regular basis. Everybody always asks me, what opportunities are there for me to get into IT work? What kind of things can I do in IT that will make me lots of money? And we get into all of these different variations on this entire topic, on this entire conversation. And the reality is a lot of people have it in their mind that, oh, computer work is easy. All I have to do is just sit here and I just type away on the keys and, oh, it'll just be wonderful. And the reality is you also have to have a temperament for computers. Not only do you have to be able to deal with people, but you have to be able to deal with the technology. And those don't always match up. I will tell you, there are plenty of computer nerds that have no people skills, and there are plenty of people who have people skills, but no computer skills. Now, if you happen to be blessed with both, there are directions you can go in. But each of the different directions involves learning a lot of different things. It involves expanding your knowledge. And it also involves, for the most part, the more money you're going to make, the more demand there is going to be on your time and your brain. One of the biggest areas that is going to be continuing for a very long time is cybersecurity. You may have heard of cybersecurity. You may be somewhat aware of the different demands of cybersecurity, but I assure you, you don't actually have a full grasp on all of the problems that we are facing with cybersecurity. It is something that here in the United States, we are somewhere right now about 3 million cybersecurity analysts shy of where we need to be. Now, that there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. That's, that does represent roughly 2% of the workforce. And this is going to be an area which is going to continue. And part of this comes from the fact that, yes, it's a specialized field. There are a lot of people who are in IT that do not have the cybersecurity chops. I have some of the knowledge in regards to cybersecurity, but I am more of an IT generalist, and I've got a couple of areas which keep me, well, very specialized areas which keep me just as well taken care of as some of the cybersecurity folks without as many headaches. I worked for a company for a while, and they were going through cybersecurity people on a regular basis. And this was a number of years ago. And part of the concern there, even in that day and age, they had cybersecurity awareness, but there was not a serious level of the officers of the company did not take it as seriously as they should have. So all of our cybersecurity analysts were well overworked. Another area, just beyond cybersecurity, there's project management. And this is more of a people area. You have to understand the tech, and you can ask questions, and you can go pretty far. But to become a project management specialist, you're going to have to get certifications, and part of those certifications require that you have project management experience. Wait a second. So I need project management experience to get the certification, but to get the certification, which will allow me to get the experience, I have to have the experience to, yes, it all becomes circular and I messed that up, but you've got the idea here, I hope. Still, it's something to look into. It's something that is in high demand. And it's more than just high demand, it's a high need. Because, yes, there is a certain level of organization that comes with some technical people. They have a certain ability to follow the logic flows of, we need to do A, then B, then C, then D, then E. But that project management specialist also specializes in communicating through a number of different people and gathering people together. And usually the higher the level of the logic that's involved with a computer nerd, the less level of, hey, can we all get along? Can we just work together on this? So it becomes a very interesting area. Those are just two areas that I think are in dramatic need, but it requires the right kind of people to do this. And I want you to think about this. I want you to think about all of IT before you decide you're going to make that jump into it. The reason why I want you to be concerned about this, to think about it, to assess yourself, is that there are a lot of people that go into a particular field and they say, oh, I'm going to become a doctor because I will make lots of money. I'm going to become a lawyer because I'm going to make lots of money. And the reality is, yeah, you make lots of money, but you also have lots of school bills, and you have lots of pressure, and you have lots of different issues, and you're going to be working far beyond the normal retirement age. Is this something that's exciting you? Is this something that's exciting you and giving you passion beyond knowing that you're going to have a big paycheck? Because I'll tell you, I know people who've gone down to that road and they've chased big paychecks and they've had miserable lives. Of course, I don't have to chase the big paycheck. I have a wonderful, happy life. It all comes down to my being a nerd. But that's another story altogether. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. When does one replace a hard disk drive or a solid-state drive? There are warning signs for impending hard disk drive failures, clicking or humming noises, PC slowdown or hanging, blue screen of death, and disk errors are signs of a failing hard disk drive. You can scan and fix hard disk drive errors using the Windows Check Disk 2, that's CHKDSK, or other hardware diagnostic tools. If your hard disk drive is too slow, no matter what solutions you try, it's time to replace the storage device. Your PC's hard disk drive stores all your relevant data, and any potential damage to the device has the potential of losing your data. A hard disk has a limited lifespan, and it will eventually become inoperable. If you're not aware of the condition of your hard drive, you may not be able to save your essential data before it's too late. You have to become conscious of the fact that not all hard drive crashes are random, and this is why backup of your data is necessary in case of failures. You really have to make sure that all your essential information is backed up before anything might happen to your hard disk. How do you find out when it's going to fail before it fails? Well, it's not always possible, and sometimes a hard disk drive will just die. But it's still important to be on alert to the symptoms of an imminent hard drive so you have a chance to back up your data and replace the drive. Sometimes hearing a strange grinding and thrashing noises means that your drive is beyond repair, for instance. If you had a head crash, it very often is, or it just could be that the motor has failed, or your hard drive is grinding away because of noisy bearings. If you're hearing strange noises, it's time to act very, very quickly. You don't have much time. Computers won't let you save a document. Oh, you're sure that you had a file on your desktop yesterday? That's nowhere to be seen today? Programs that always work suddenly stop working. Asking where a file it depends on is stored. These are all potential signs that your hard drive is on its way out. Of course, it could be that your kids move your files for fun, or a virus is eating through them. But disappearing data is never a good sign for your drive if you can rule out those alternative causes. Windows has a built-in disk check tool, also known as Check Disk, CHKDSK, that can scan your hard drive for bad sectors, marking hard ones as bad and repairing soft ones to make them usable again. If Windows thinks that there's a problem on your hard disk because the hard drive's dirty bit is set, it will automatically run this tool when your computer starts up. But you're also free to run this tool manually at any point. Bad sectors are just a reality of hard disk drives, and there's generally no reason to panic when you encounter one. However, you should always have backups of your important files just in case a freak bad sector strikes, and rapidly developing bad sectors can certainly suggest oncoming hard drive failures. Well, what about solid-state drives? Solid-state drives have been around for some time. They were first invented in 1976 by Dataram. Now solid-state devices or drives are accessible in a way they've never been before. They found their way into many consumer electronics. Solid-state drives have gained widespread popularity in the last 10 to 15 years. They're faster, use little power, they're compact and durable, and because they don't have any moving parts, they're considered more reliable than hard disk drives. How long does a solid-state drive last? Current estimates put the age limit for solid-state drives around 10 years, though the average solid-state lifespan is shorter. In fact, a joint study between Google and the University of Toronto tested solid-state drives over a multi-year period. During that study, they found the age of a solid-state drive was the primary determinant of when it stopped working. The downside of solid-state drives with the NAND flash-based chips is that they have a limited lifespan by default. While normal hard disk drives can, in theory, last forever, but in reality, they only last about 10 years maximum, solid-state drives have a built-in time of death. To keep it simple, an electric effect results from the fact that data can only be written on a storage cell inside the chips between approximately 3,000 to 100,000 times during its lifetime. After that, the cells forget new data, and because of this fact, and to prevent certain cells from getting used all the time while others aren't, the manufacturers use wear leveling algorithms to distribute data evenly over all cells by the controller. Usually, manufacturers give an estimate with so-called terabytes written, TBW, especially when it comes to enterprise solid-state drives, but also for consumer versions. Because of the fact that by using wear leveling, The data will be distributed evenly over all cells. This figure is supposed to tell how much data can be really written in total on all cells inside the storage chips and over the whole lifespan. A typical TBW figure for a 250 gigabyte solid-state drive lies between 60 and 150 terabytes written. That means to get over guaranteed TBW of 70, a user would have to write 190 gigabytes daily over a period of 1 year. In other words, to fill two-thirds of the solid-state drive with new data every day, and in a consumer environment, this is not likely. What happens when solid-state drive reaches write limit? When it does reach that, your warranty will be void, if it's not already due to the age. Most likely, nothing will go wrong with a solid-state drive for a long time after. Solid-state drive manufacturers tend to greatly underestimate the write capacity of their drives. Eventually, the drive will slow down and then stop working altogether. Well, how do you check your solid-state drive endurance? If you can see how much lifetime data you've written on your current solid-state drive, you can estimate its remaining lifespan. There's a program. You can download Crystal Disk Mark. That's CrystalDiskMark. And after you download it, install it. Run the app and it will tell you the current state of your solid-state drive. If the app tells you it's good, you don't have anything to worry about. In some cases where the solid-state drive supports it, you will also be able to see a percentage for its health and how much data you've written on it so far. Just remember, recovery can cost thousands and thousands of dollars. The cost of transferring a backup onto a brand new drive is much cheaper than having to find a recovery specialist. Google announced that they will stop third-party cookies in Chrome. As almost any computer user on the internet know, cookies are text files with small pieces of data like a username and password that are used to identify your computer as you use a computer network. Specific cookies known as HTTP cookies are used to identify specific users and improve your web browsing experience. Google announced in that they will stop the use of third-party cookies in Chrome before 2022, joining a growing list of browsers ditching the notorious tracking technology. Third-party cookies, also known as tracking cookies or trackers, are created by parties other than the website that the user is currently visiting, providers of advertising, retargeting, analytics, and tracking services. What are first-party cookies? First-party cookies are created by the host domain, the domain the user is visiting. These types of cookies are generally considered good. Well, that's what they say. They help provide a better user experience and keep the session open. This basically means the browser is able to remember key pieces of information, such as which items you add to shopping carts, your username, and passwords, and language preferences. Third-party cookies are those created by domains other than the one the user is visiting at the time, and are mainly used for tracking and online advertising purposes. They also allow website owners to provide certain services, such as live chats. In addition to first-party cookie being created by the host site, somenewsite.com, a third-party cookie is also created by ad.doubleclick.net. The reason for third-party cookie is because the URL doesn't match the domain and the cookie is left by a third-party advertising provider, hence the name third-party cookie. Well, U.S. government is not doing anything about it, but the United Kingdom is investigating Google's controversial plan to kill third-party cookies. The United Kingdom's competition watchdog will investigate Google's controversial privacy sandbox project that will disable third-party cookies on the Chrome browser and Chromium browser engine. The Competition Market Authority, CMA, announced on Friday that it will investigate the project, which see Google replace third-party cookies with a new set of tools for targeting advertising that the company claims will protect consumers' privacy to a great extent over concerns that advertising revenues will become even more concentrated on Google's ecosystem at the expense of its competitors. The CMA says it has received a number of complaints about Privacy Sandbox, including one from Marketers for an Open Web, a group of newspaper publishers and technology companies, which argue that Google is abusing its dominant position through the browser changes. In a recent marketing study, the CMA, or the Competition Markets Authority itself, found that Google's Privacy Sandbox proposal will potentially have a very significant impact on publishers like newspapers and the digital advertising market. Google could undermine the ability of publishers to generate revenue and undermine competition in digital advertising, entrenching Google's market power. The Competition Markets Authority said, adding that given those concerns, the CMA says it has decided to conduct a formal investigation into Google's as-yet unfinalized changes. The regulator said it has an open mind and has not reached any conclusions at this stage as to whether any laws have been broken. It added that it will continue to work with Google to address both privacy and competition concerns as development of new tools progresses. In a statement, Google said it will continue to collaborate with technologists, businesses, publishers, regulators, and others before making any changes in 2022. Creating a more private web while also enabling the publishers and advertisers who support the free and open internet requires the industry to make major changes to the way digital advertising works. The Privacy Sandbox has been an open initiative since the beginning, and Google welcomes the CMA's involvement as they work to develop new proposals to underpin a healthy ad-supported web without third-party cookies. Can we get back to a more relevant question? Why any cookies at all? Presenting Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, getting water out of its shell.
To paraphrase a credit card commercial, what's in your water? We're calling this report Getting Water Out of Its Shell, and before it's over, you'll have a better sense, a better idea of what alternatives you have for your own home. And I mean alternatives to things like, lugging those huge bags of salt, for starters. But the starters for this report ask you to think big, as in the really big users of water. Huge volumes of water, farms, industrial plants, municipal water systems, golf courses, baseball and football and sports and park fields. What's crazy is how much it can all happen with less water and still get better results. Without adding magic crystals, without adding anything to the water, no chemical consumables, no power, just some really clever science stuff that doesn't sound like it should work, but does. Let's start audaciously. At some time or another, everyone encounters claims for a product that can't possibly be true. You challenge them, show me the science. And the response you get might be science or might just throw together a lot of words that sound like science. So, for me, my first response when I heard about magnets somehow conditioning water was a single word. Phooey. Impossible. Okay, two words. Maybe if there were iron floating in the water, maybe some magnets on a pipe could stop it from flowing through. And as soon as there was enough to clog the pipe, nothing else would ever flow through. But that would be okay with them, because they would have long ago pocketed your money. When I first ran into magnation, candidly, I was just looking for a way to dodge hauling salt pellets to a brine tank, and what they told me didn't much sound like science. They were talking about water having energy and some transformation of crystals. None of it made sense to me, but I review products, so I had them send me one, and it seemed to work. Just pouring water through made that water taste smoother, and my meter showed the pH getting neutralized. How could a magnet do that? There was only one choice. Forget about their explanation and figure it out based on the established science that most of us started learning by high school. That would be a challenge. If you're not already familiar with all the claims they make, check these out. Stop Hard Mineral Scale. oust dissolved solids, neutralize pH, make water flow better so you don't need as much energy to pump it, reach crop and turf hydration targets with less water, accelerate and improve germination, improve root health, reduce the amount of fertilizer needed, improve plant resistance to pests, reduce evaporation, reduce salinity, deliver calcium nutrients to plants without encouraging limescale, and calcium for people, too, for stronger bones and teeth. They claim to address and correct chlorides, bicarbonates, hydrogen sulfide, boron, manganese, iron bacteria, sulfates, nitrates, algae, biofilm, plumbing corrosion, and more. Know what the worst part was? When we got in touch with people already using their products, none of them took any issue with any of this. That took phooey and impossible off the table and left a problem to solve, one of physics and physical chemistry, and whoa, a light came on. Truthfully, it was a memory of a light that came on more than half a century ago, in science class, studying electricity. A loop of wire connected to a small light bulb. When the loop moved between the poles of a strong horseshoe magnet, the bulb lit up. That was a demonstration of the Faraday effect, which is the basis of electrical generators and the alternators in our cars. But where were the wires and what was the bulb in the water? Well, think about it. Source water is never just water. It has a lot of dissolved solids, none of which are insulators. It has other things riding along. Flow that stuff past a magnet, and all those things pick up electrical charges. The ends of those little tidbits immediately start attracting and repelling each other and crashing into each other and breaking up into smaller and smaller particles. All that agitation, the scientific term for this kind of churning is perturbation. Well, that's just the first step. That stuff isn't just passing a single magnet. It's passing several magnets, cleverly positioned, to continue that disruptive effect inside the water. The magnetization device also features internal geometries that encourage the water to swirl as it continues, and a slight downstream taper introduces back pressure. That's somewhere between a Bernoulli effect and a Venturi effect, but what's more important is that the water is starting to spin, and because of the back pressure, to form a small vortex. That makes two things happen at the same time. One is centrifugation, the centrifuge effect, like the gravity G's you feel on a lot of amusement park rides. In science, a centrifuge separates things according to their molecular density. Solids and liquids and gases, including all the little smithereens of those dissolved solids and that ride-along stuff. At the same time, those things are starting to organize themselves because they're still carrying that initial electrical charge. They cluster. The scientific term is agglomerate and sometimes flocculate. It's like speed dating in a line of perfect mates. They join into larger, less smithereened clusters, too big to stick to the walls of pipes. And the centrifuge action has separated them from each other and from the water that brought them. Everything is now swimming in its own lanes. Some of these structures are compounds, but not the ones you usually see in most treated water. The most significant example is calcium, which doesn't bond to become hard and stubborn calcium carbonate, known by its thug name, limescale. Instead, it forms calcium aragonite, which is soft and powdery, so even where it does stick, there isn't nearly as much, and it isn't nearly as stubborn. But the important outcome here is that these processes have separated out everything that isn't really water that came in with the water, leaving only what is water flowing in its own swim lane. And that brings up one other significant player, the Moses effect, which reduces the coefficient of friction between the water itself and the plumbing that's delivering it. The Moses effect happens when water gets exposed to supermagnets, like the neodymium magnets in the magnation products. That's what is happening. Here's what isn't happening. The brine tanks of traditional consumables-based water softeners aren't adding salinity to the water and aren't robbing the plants or people who use the water of the calcium that's important to their health. If you're just a homeowner, this kind of water treatment is interesting because you never again have to buy those heavy bags of salt pellets. You still get great suds and lather for washing. You're not having to replace lime-clogged plumbing. Nothing needs any power. Nothing needs any attention or maintenance. And everything you make with water, even coffee, delivers bolder, enhanced flavors. But if your interest is in water for farming, turf, cooling systems, production processes, or municipal systems, there's a lot more on the table. Your pumps will draw 10 to 30% less power. You'll see the same or better results using 20 to 30% less water. Water will hydrate better, evaporate less, experience less blowdown, and yield more results. You'll be able to reduce your purchases of chemicals for water treatment, fertilization, or other challenges by 10 to 50%. Pumps and pipes will need less maintenance, so you'll deal with less downtime. It's still all just science. Okay, maybe science and a little economics. Anyway, it's all just plain smart. Next time, you can join us for a ride down slippery memory lane. How many times has something remarkable happened right in front of you while you were driving, and all you could do was talk about it later because there wasn't any way to take a picture or shoot a video? But that's all yours for the sharing when there's a dash cam along for the ride. Our report is Wingman Chronicles, about better reasons to use a dash cam than just waiting for somebody to hit you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit their website and get the necessary meeting ID for the teleconference meeting. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on speech recognition Thursday, January the 14th. At 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on a PC user's guide for avoiding the grief of losing your information. Thursday, January the 28th, meeting time 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, their website is acgnj.org. The Princeton PC Users Group, their website is ptcug-nj.apcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group, their website is limac.org. The Westchester PC Users Group, their website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of this program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.